This is the takeaway for Wednesday, January 17th, 2018.
Perhaps you have figured it out by now, but little girls don't stay little forever. They grow into strong women that return to destroy your world.
A courtroom in Lansing, Michigan, filled this week with the voices of women confronting their abuser.
You used my body for 6 years for your own sexual gratification. That is unforgivable.
This is The Takeaway. I'm Todd Zwillick. Thanks for being with us today. Nearly 100 women and girls are stepping up to tell their stories of sexual abuse this week. Abuse by one man, former USA Gymnastics doctor Larry Nassar. Nassar pled guilty to 7 counts of first-degree criminal sexual misconduct. On Tuesday, 14 women and girls stood up in court to deliver their victim impact statements directly to their abuser. And a warning here, their words contain graphic descriptions of the abuse they endured.
He had me lie down on the table, and he sexually assaulted me. He touched the most innocent places on my body that day.
He sexually assaulted me under the guise as a medical doctor. I trusted him.
Why was I the 9-year-old? I've looked into my parents' hardened eyes, seeing their pain from now knowing that their only child was molested right in front of them in the same room. Someday I will have to explain to my children why I am the way I am, my reasons for being cautious and fearful. Now I get flashbacks when I see male hands, and it makes me feel scared and threatened. This fear changed the way I grew up and how I related to boys. I couldn't be just a normal girl anymore, and I have forever lost a big piece of my childhood due to his abuse.
She took her own life because she couldn't deal with the pain anymore. And it all started with him. It all started with him.
My career has suffered tremendously from the distractions and the pain I am feeling. There's not a day that passes that I don't think about the monster that created this mess. Your Honor, with your permission, I would now like to address the defendant.
You may.
After my parents confronted you, they brought you back to my house to speak with me. Sitting on my living room couch, I listened to you tell me, no one should ever do that, and if they do, you should tell someone. Well, Larry, I'm here, not to tell someone, but to tell everyone.
The voices there of Kyle Stevens, Jessica Tomashaw, Annette Hill, Olivia Cowan, Alexis Moore, and the mother of deceased abuse victim Chelsea Markham. Just a few of those who were abused or who saw loved ones abused by Larry Nassar. They spoke as part of Nassar's sentencing hearing that began on Tuesday. He already faces 60 years in prison on 3 child pornography charges, and these sexual abuse charges could add 125 more. A total of 98 women are slated to give impact statements before the hearing is done in Michigan. Most are current or former gymnasts who were young at the time of the assault. All told, more than 140 female athletes say Nassar assaulted them. Among them are Olympians like Simone Biles, who came forward with her own story this week. Lindsay Gibbs is sports reporter at Think Progress and co-host of the sports and feminism podcast Burn It All Down. Lindsay, welcome back to The Takeaway.
Thanks for having me.
Well, let's go back to the crimes themselves. Remind us who Dr. Nassar is, what he's accused of, and what he's pled guilty to.
Dr. Larry Nassar was an elite trainer with the USA gymnastics team. He worked at 4 Olympic Games. He was a doctor for the gymnast. He worked at the Caroli Ranch, which is where these girls train for elite competition. And he was also a doctor at MSU. He treated patients at Michigan State University. He had a practice there and treated not only gymnasts, but other athletes in the program. He is accused of sexually abusing over 150 girls and women. And he did most of that abuse under the guise of medical treatment. So he would say he was treating them for back pain or hip pain. And during that time, he would, without gloves, abuse them and oftentimes would do so while aroused. He was very skilled. He would often do this with parents in the room. And he would use his body to cover the abuse. And he was so well respected within the community, it was considered an honor to be treated by him. And so he was able to continue abusing for decades.
And these athletes, these former athletes, Lindsay, coming forward now to testify, to face their abuser in public. Many have chosen to do it. Some have not. You've spoken to some of them as well. What has this moment meant for them? I can't imagine what it's like, but I can imagine for some it's therapeutic and cathartic, and I can imagine for others it's extraordinarily traumatic.
Yeah, and I think for most it's both. The devastating thing about listening to these victims talk, and I think we will hear almost 100 over the next few days of testimony, is how preventable this all was. You know, the first reports about Nassar's abuse came forward in 1996, and 1997 is when officials at Michigan State University or at club-level gyms where he was treating patients. That's when adults, people in charge, were first told about this and nothing was done. So you're just after victim, you just think this didn't have to happen. This was preventable. And that's what's devastating, I think, to so many of the women, including Rachel Denhollander, who I know we will hear from. And she was the first victim to publicly come forward and accuse Larry Nassar of sexual assault. And to her, it's just so hard to hear story after story while knowing that none of this trauma had to happen.
Well, Lindsay, you interviewed Rachel Denhollander for your podcast, Burn It All Down. She's a former gymnast in the program, now a lawyer. She was the first woman to publicly come forward against Larry Nassar. You talked to her about Michigan State.
So when you look at this overall picture of how MSU has handled complaints of sexual assault, it's been abhorrent. It's been absolutely abhorrent. And MSU's response to that is, well, we didn't deliberately cover up. We didn't know Larry was a sexual abuser. Yeah, and that's a smokescreen. That's a red herring. Because enabling doesn't usually look like someone saying, oh, you're a rapist and rape is okay, so we're going to let you keep on raping. Enabling looks like deliberate indifference. It looks like extreme negligence. It looks like silencing the victims. It looks like an immediate presumption of innocence for the perpetrator. It looks like everything you saw at MSU.
Michigan State's gymnastics program is an elite program in the NCAA. It's one of the top gymnastics programs. And Larry Nassar's prestige, being associated with USA Gymnastics, working with these Olympians. I mean, if you think back to iconic moments in gymnastics history, he was one of the doctors who helped Carrie Strug off the mat in 1996 after her famous vault on her hurt ankle when she couldn't walk off the mat, but she won gold for the United States team. He was so prestigious, and they used that in recruiting. They used that to establish credibility for the program.
You also talked to Rachel about not only the difficulty, but the importance of kind of blowing the lid off a tight-knit community like gymnastics, like this athletic program.
Abusers always have some sort of community that surrounds them. It may be a sports community. It may be a university community. It may be a political community, a religious community. It might be a physical community. From a societal standpoint and a cultural standpoint, the lesson that we really need to learn here is the same lesson we need to learn everywhere else. We need to be willing to speak against our own community. Because speaking against our own community is the thing that people are most unlikely to do, and it's the thing we most desperately need.
And it's really hard to see people that you know and love, and often abusers are very charismatic people who not only groom their victims, but groom the people around them. At Michigan State, that's where these policies really fail. At Michigan State in 2014, there was a police investigation by the Michigan State Police Department when a girl came forward to report his abuse. And they decided after an investigation that this was a legitimate medical procedure and that there was no legitimacy to her complaint. At the same time, Michigan State's Title IX office launched an investigation, and they found that these girls did not understand the, quote, nuanced difference between abuse and procedures. Now, remember, Nassar was penetrating them digitally, not with gloves, not after asking their permission or talking them through the procedure. And he was often getting aroused and touching them elsewhere on their bodies during these procedures. This was abuse. But what's interesting is at Michigan State, in that Title IX review back in 2014, the people on the panel who reviewed these procedures were all people who had known Nassar and who had worked with him and who loved him. And one of the doctors on this panel was even handpicked by Larry Nassar to talk, you know, to review this. So you once again see these communities, whether it's they might be convincing themselves that this is an abuse because they don't want to believe this person that they work with is an abuser. But that's inexcusable because you're hurting these girls and victims. And to tell a woman, in college that she doesn't know the difference between a medical procedure and sexual assault, that's just horrific.
It might remind people in so many ways, Lindsay, of the systemic decades of abuse in the Catholic Church, which had a lot of different factors involved, some of them in some ways similar to this, but communities of people in the church where the church was central to their lives who just wouldn't believe that this kind of thing could go on, and it was perpetuated.
You can't overstate how well-respected this man was and how it was presented as being an honor to be treated by him. When you dedicate your life to a sport like these young women have done to gymnastics, you're willing to do anything. You're taught to do anything. These families on the elite level sacrifice everything they have to get their daughters to this dream. And it makes it so much easier when all this happens to overlook warning signs, which is why organizations like Michigan State Athletic Department and like USA Gymnastics need to have procedures in place, and they need to be the adults in the room.
Well, Lindsay, Michigan State is just one school. USA Gymnastics is a gigantic organization, and Larry Nassar, for as bad as it was, is just one guy. It suggests that he's most likely not the only person in a position of power who's been abusing women and girls in gymnastics or in similar sports.
Absolutely. This is much bigger than Larry Nassar, both in USA Gymnastics and in the sporting community at large. In USA Gymnastics in particular, it's important to remember that this all started in 2016 with an Indy Star investigation into the systematic enabling of sexual abuse by USA Gymnastics. That original investigation did not mention Larry Nassar's name once. It was talking about how the systems that USA Gymnastics had in place had allowed dozens upon dozens, if not more, predators to continue to work with gymnasts across their system. And it was only after that report came out that Rachel Denhollander came forward with the name Larry Nassar to the end of Indy Star investigators. And after that, it came forward that actually USA Gymnastics had already launched an investigation into Larry Nassar's behavior. The FBI was looking into him. But at that point, this is 2016, that USA Gymnastics and FBI investigation began in 2015. He was still working at MSU when that investigation was launched. But back to your point, this is much bigger than Larry Nassar. And there's been great reporting recently, particularly by the Washington Post, about how systemic this is in so many Olympic sports.
Lindsay Gibbs, sports reporter at Think Progress, host of the Burn It All Down podcast. Lindsay, thanks for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
We have a story now from Baltimore that's raised questions about how hospitals treat and discharge patients who can't take care of themselves. Psychotherapist Imamu Baraka was walking outside of his office in downtown Baltimore across the street from the University of Maryland Medical Center, and there he saw hospital staff wheeling a woman to a bus stop outside where they dropped her off wearing only a hospital gown and socks in nearly freezing temperatures. Baraka took out his cell phone and he started recording.
Wait, so y'all just gonna leave this lady out here with no clothes on?
Ladies and gentlemen, I'm at a local hospital where individuals have left a patient half naked on the city streets. And it's about 30 degrees out here right now. And I am not sure why this is even happening. But we're gonna find out. Ma'am, are you okay?
That's footage from Imamu Baraka's cell phone. It was all over the local news in Baltimore. It's now been viewed 3.5 million times on Facebook alone. The woman in the video appears unable to speak and is wandering up and down the street in that hospital gown. The hospital issued an apology for failing to provide, quote, basic humanity and compassion. But stories like this are an example of a practice known as patient dumping, and it's not unique to one hospital in Baltimore. Dr. Arthur Kaplan is here. He's director of the Division of Medical Ethics at the New York University School of Medicine. Dr. Kaplan, thanks for coming back.
Hey, Todd. Thanks for having me.
Dr. Kaplan, when you saw this video that Imamu Baraka took on his phone and got the news in Baltimore, hospital workers apparently leaving a woman at a bus stop in a gown and socks, what did you see?
Well, I saw someone doing a very heroic thing in terms of intervening, doing the tape. You know, patient dumping, when a hospital says in its emergency room, we don't want you here anymore, we're too busy to deal with a psychiatric patient or a complex case, it's very hard to know how much dumping goes on. By law, you are not supposed to be doing that. We passed a law in 1986 under Reagan to get rid of patient dumping. It requires emergency rooms to send people to safe environments, a shelter, someplace where they're going to be okay once they come out of the ER. There have been about, in the past 5 years, at least 200 documented cases of patient dumping. The Inspector General of the Department of Health and Human Services, which is supposed to enforce that federal law, got reports on at least 200 cases, and that's 200 too many.
So, Dr. Kaplan, the law says you're not supposed to discharge a patient without a care plan. You can't just dump them on the street like we apparently saw in this case. Does it depend on what that patient's mental state or mental status is, or even their medical state? How is that evaluated? Who decides whether this is a case of dumping or not?
You basically have a written plan. When someone is discharged from the ER, the hospital is required to make a note and say, here's what we did for treatment. And remember, the lady came in, I think, in this case, with a pretty bad cut. And then they're supposed to say, and here's the discharge plan. We got social services. We put her in a taxi and sent her over to a halfway house, whatever the plan has been. And that's where the inspectors would come and say, well, either you didn't do what you said your plan is, or you didn't have a plan.
So it sounds like a discharge plan is one thing. If a patient has no home to go to, how do hospitals handle homeless people who can't stay in the hospital but have nowhere else to go?
Yeah, they're trying to send them to shelters. And Todd, this is a really important point. Look, I'm very angry at that hospital in Baltimore for just dumping a clearly incapacitated person out on a bench in a cold night in a hospital gown. I mean, it's not safe. It's wrong. It's immoral. But this country has yet to come to grips with how do we deal with the homeless, particularly the homeless who are mentally ill. That isn't an ER problem. That's a public problem. So when you say, you know, where are you sending her? Well, in a lot of cities, there may not be any room at the shelter. In rural areas, there may not be a shelter. We have a bigger problem than just what ERs are doing on discharge. And that is, we've got a lot of folks who are homeless, who have mental illness, and we're not taking care of them.
And from the hospital's perspective, Dr. Kaplan, they've said, and hospital administrators have said clearly, they did the wrong thing. University of Maryland says they failed, but what contributes in the system to this happening? Is it strictly resources? When you look at running an ER at night, what they can treat, what they don't, and why they would dump a patient like this, what's going on?
Well, it is resources, and it's also a bias toward the ability to pay. I'm pretty sure if you had insurance, they'd keep you in the waiting room overnight and wouldn't send you out in your gown to a bench. They just hang on to you and say, sit over there until, daybreak came. And then they come up with some plan to let you go. You know, it's resource constraints. ERs are overwhelmed as we see more cuts taking place in community healthcare centers, in Medicaid programs. More people get to the ER. We're in the middle of flu season. ERs get jammed up then. People get busy. They say, I can't deal with this person. I stitched up her cut. I got to move on to the next person. And then there's just the resources that we as a society make available to take care of the demented homeless. And, I'm just going to say it's a moral scandal. These are very vulnerable people. We don't give the hospitals a place, really, to send this kind of person to get basic humane protection from the elements.
Well, Dr. Kaplan, I want to give one more word here to Imamu Baraka, the gentleman who made that video, who said that the head of the University of Maryland Medical Center reached out to him to thank him.
Fix it. I'm not interested in your words, but from where I'm from, you want to thank me? Fix it.
He says, you want to thank me? Fix it. Art Kaplan, fixing this sounds like it's a deep systemic problem.
deep systemic problem, really one of trying to take care of all those people with a wide variety of mental illnesses who are just out there frequently in cold and dangerous environments. You know, I'm not trying to let that hospital off the hook. They should never have let her out. They should have just sat her in a chair until daytime came and they could figure out how to get her to some kind of a shelter. But there aren't enough shelters, and we don't have the right kind of safety net for that kind of person.
And it strikes me, Dr. Art Kaplan, that you and I would not even be having this conversation at all if it weren't for the conscientious action of one guy on a street with a cell phone.
A lot of moral heroism there, taking the time, being concerned. I really think he gets kudos.
Dr. Art Kaplan, Director of the Division of Medical Ethics at New York University School of Medicine. Art, thanks so much.
Hey, thank you.
There's a massive plume of a colorless, toxic, highly flammable fossil fuel in the East China Sea, and that plume is getting bigger. It's from the Iranian oil tanker Sanchi, which collided with another ship off the coast of China in the first week of January and burned for days before sinking over the weekend. All 32 members of the crew are presumed dead now. The ship was full of a type of oil called condensate, and hopes that the spill could be contained or burned off are now fears that it could rival the 1989 Exxon Valdez disaster in terms of severity. Andrew Friedman is senior science editor at Mashable. He's here with me. Andrew, thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me.
What do we know, Andrew, about the size and severity of this spill from Sanchi?
So we know what it was carrying. We know that it had 1 million barrels of this very light type of oil. We know that it has bunker fuel, which is a very heavy type of fuel oil that was powering the ship. We know that it leaked a considerable amount onto the surface, and we know that it's probably leaking in the water column now that it's sunk.
So now that the ship is at the bottom of the ocean, you said this is a very light form of fuel, this condensate, leaking from ostensibly the hull of the ship right into the water.
Yeah, ostensibly leaking from the hull of the ship into the water, and it's highly toxic. The type of oil that you're not going to see these pictures, dramatic pictures of birds coated with oil on their wings.
Not crude.
It's not like crude oil like the Exxon Valdez was. But the thing is, it was carrying so much of it that there's a concern that the toxicity in that region will be so great for a relatively short period of time that it will cause marine fishery fatalities, that it will cause long-term effects on some of the marine mammals that transit through there. There are whales that go through there. And there are important fisheries there, mackerel, types of bluefin, as well as other stuff in the East China Sea.
What happens when condensate gets into the water? You said some of it's on the surface. Does it essentially dissolve and make a toxic soup?
The water that the condensate that's on the surface tends to chemically react with the air and mix out. So it eventually kind of evaporates or it burns off. They're seeing a sheen of oil expand to something like 50 square miles, I believe it was yesterday. But they don't expect that to be there for very long. These are pretty open, turbulent ocean waters. The bigger concern is what is happening with the bunker fuel and the condensate below the water surface.
Now, in terms of comparing this disaster to the Exxon Valdez, people, of course, remember the images of wildlife coated in oil. This is different, as you said. In terms of scale or impact, how are those two things compared?
So there's a lot of differences between the two. The Exxon Valdez happened in more of a contained, less rough bay area, and the oil, you know, wasn't spreading over a huge domain. This, you know, 1 million barrels of oil is a lot of oil. So we know it's not good. We know that the scale of this could be one of the largest spills in five decades or so, possibly dating back to the Exxon Valdez. But in talking to fisheries experts, in talking to environmental activists, there's a lot of unknowns right now. And there's a lot of people eagerly awaiting more information from the Chinese authorities who are trying to ascertain how much of what has gotten into the environment.
And also what cleanup might look like, if cleanup is even possible in this case, or if you just have to wait for the condensate to dissolve or evaporate. A major spill in the East China Sea. Andrew Friedman is the senior science editor at Mashable. Thanks for being here.
Thank you for having me.
Cape Town, South Africa is running out of water, and quickly. They call it day zero, the day the taps run dry in Cape Town, and day zero has now crept up to April 22nd. The government in Cape Town is racing to build desalination plants and drill boreholes into aquifers deep underground, but residents are already lining up to get water, and rationing could be in their future. Here's Cape Town Mayor Patricia de Lille speaking at a water drilling site earlier this month.
Day zero is now projected to be the 22nd of April. This is the first in the history ever of the city of Cape Town. They'll be going to drill for water and extract that water. We must make sure that we can avoid day zero.
For more, let's go to Cape Town now. Wendell Rolf is correspondent for Reuters. Wendell, welcome.
Thanks for having me.
Well, Wendell, just how bad is the situation in Cape Town? Can you feel or see that something's going wrong with the water?
Well, no, absolutely. We are currently being battered by a severe drought. It's the worst drought to hit the city in more than a century. Gardens are brown. People are having to line up at sort of free water spots to try and get water. The effect of the drought is tangible.
Well, what's caused this shortage, Wendell? There's a drought, you just mentioned it, but it's not the first. Why is Cape Town running dry now?
I think some people have suggested that it's a lack of foresight on the city of Cape Town. You are correct. It's not the first drought. However, it is a major drought. There was a drought a few years ago in 2009, previously in 2003 as well, when the notion of desalination plants were also mooted. What's happened now is that this year, the last 12 to 24 months, the drought has been very severe. And what's been happening is that Cape Town gets most of its water supply from dams. These dams are parched, they are cracked, and there's a dwindling water supply. And that is causing the city now to try and get water elsewhere. As the mayor mentioned, by drilling ancient aquifers, by building temporary desalination plants. But some have suggested that it's a little bit too late.
Is Cape Town trucking water in from other parts of the country? What else are they doing?
No, not that bad. I think the mitigation factors are working. Capetonians, they have very much come to the party. 2 years ago, in January 2016, we were using daily consumption of about 1.1 billion liters of water. With a very massive public awareness campaign, the city is trying to halve that initial consumption rate to 500 million liters of water. But it's touch and go.
Cape Town is a city with a lot of economic disparity, big differences between rich and poor. I would imagine that water shortages and the need to cut water probably affects people in much the same way.
The statement is very correct. You have the vast majority of people who live in shanty towns where there is hardly any access to clean running water. And on the flip side of the coin, you have exceptionally rich areas where the people have huge pools, where they have sprinkler systems. However, I think as the city has also mentioned, they are keen not to engage in a blame game because even the more affluent residents are also trying their bit. But I think it would be a common cause to suggest that those more affluent areas are using more water than the poorer areas.
So, Wendell, people talk about day zero in Cape Town, the day the city runs out of water. What has this done to the culture in the city for something so basic to all of a sudden be so very scarce? Is it pulling people together? Is it driving them apart?
If you recall, a few years ago, not only the city, but South Africa, there was a power shortage. And now that has been overcome. And now we're sitting with a water shortage. Are people coming together? Yes. But again, I think there could be a class analogy. The richer, more affluent residents of Cape Town can afford to buy water. The poorer residents, not necessarily so. People across racial, across class, are being assailed on a daily basis with the news that please conserve water. Don't waste water. So yes, I think everybody is pulling together. Nobody wants to stand in a queue.
Wendell Rolf in Cape Town, South Africa, reporting as that city nears the point where it goes dry, day zero. Wendell, thank you.
Thank you very much, Todd.
Thanks for being with us on The Takeaway today. I'm Todd Zwillick. We return now to our coverage of sanctions against North Korea and its nuclear missile program. There was a broad consensus at Tuesday's 20-nation meeting on North Korea in Vancouver that North Korea should pay for its bad behavior and that sanctions are the solution. Now, yesterday, I talked with Anthony Ruggiero. He's a former government expert on sanctions and nuclear proliferation, and he agreed, saying sanctions haven't gone far enough.
We just simply have not had enough sanctions against North Korea. You know, since February 2016, sanctions have more than doubled, which, you know, really cuts against the myth from some folks that there was not more to sanction or that North Korea had been sanctioned out.
Well, we want to get another perspective now on sanctions, because not everyone sees aggressive sanctions from the U.S. and the United Nations as an effective tool for dealing with North Korea. Dr. Ki Bee Park is a neurosurgeon at Harvard Medical School. He's also director of the North Korean program at the Korean American Medical Association. He's been to North Korea 17 times, and he says that sanctions aren't working. Dr. Park, welcome to The Takeaway.
Thanks for having me, Todd.
Well, doctor, as you know, sanctions are a central part of American and international pressure against North Korea as it developed nuclear weapons and then ballistic missiles. You heard Anthony Ruggiero there say that sanctions haven't worked because they haven't been strong enough. What do you say?
That's an interesting point that people who favor sanctions state that they don't work until they do. But the issue that I like to take with them is the humanitarian impact that's having on the people of North Korea, the most vulnerable population. That aspect has been left out of the discussion. It's a humanitarian crisis, the hunger issue, the health issues for North Korean people. That's one aspect of it. Obviously, you know, if you want to talk about whether sanctions work or not, that's another discussion. But I will say that the objective of the sanctions is to stop the North Koreans from developing nuclear weapons further, the ballistic missiles program. I think the time is on their side. They were almost done with their program. In fact, some people believe that they're de facto nuclear state now. So if the Americans are trying to stop them by applying sanctions, I think it's too late, number one. Number two, the sanctions are not enforceable, at least the UN sanctions. As many as 49 countries may be in violation of these sanctions. And then even Trump has said whether or not the sanctions are working. So I don't know why we continue on this path. I think it's clear that talks have to start, but they're applying these sanctions with huge humanitarian costs. And now they're cutting off almost all fuel supply to North Koreans. And I just think that's just misguided.
Well, Dr. Park, in many ways, how sanctions affect a country's economy is a matter of priorities. That's what Anthony Ruggiero basically said on this show yesterday. Listen to him here talking about the human cost of sanctions.
The North Korean regime does not care about their own people. This is a circumstance where the regime has no care for its people and is happy to use that as an excuse to lessen the sanctions.
Dr. Park, you hear Anthony Ruggiero there saying that the North Korean government's priorities are basically flipped and that it's not the sanctions that's causing food and medicine shortages, it's the government.
Right. So let's talk about that. The government has priorities. The priority for the regime's survival supersedes some of the social programs. And then, of course, North Korea is pretty well known for their human rights violations. But I can tell you from the healthcare standpoint, North Korea has one of the best public health systems that I have seen. They have a very centralized system with huge healthcare workforce. And what's interesting is that they spend now up to 6.4% of their GDP on healthcare for North Korean people. And that has increased over the last 10 years as these sanctions have ratcheted up. So for someone to say the government doesn't care about North Korean people, I reject that just purely on what I've observed, at least in the healthcare aspect. So, yeah, I don't agree with Mr. Ruggiero on that.
Still, before I let you go, Dr. Park, let's look at Iran, because there is an example of sanctions there. You know, tough sanctions are credited even by opponents of the Iran deal for bringing Iran to the negotiating table and making that Iran nuclear deal possible. Even people who don't like the deal say that at least sanctions worked in that case.
So, yeah, the Iran example is used as where, you know, they brought the Iranians to the table and there was an agreement. So North Koreans have said, we'll talk. So if the purpose of the sanctions is at least to sit down and let's start talking about, you know, where we're going to go with all this, the North Koreans have already said that. The problem is that the Americans have said, we'll talk with you as long as we're going to talk about denuclearization. That's a non-starter. But let's talk about the differences between Iran and North Korea. Iran had a very robust economy with a global commerce, especially their oil exports. Then it was cut off, and that has a huge impact. People are entrenched in that economy. The North Koreans, on the other hand, are completely used to isolation and self-sufficiency and scarcity and hardship. In fact, that's their national motto called Juche, which is total self-sufficiency. So we're talking about two different kinds of people altogether. And then, of course, there's that how much influence the general public has with the regime. That's another issue, and maybe different from Iran and North Korea.
Well, Dr. Park, it does seem like sanctions are likely to go forward. I think it's fair to say that most of the governments and the UN do think that sanctions are the way to go. So where are you worried this strategy might be headed?
There are direct human costs. People are starving. People aren't getting the necessary medical care that they need. Life-saving medicines are being withheld. We need to be responsible when we apply these policies for good reasons. I totally support denuclearization. But we have to be mindful of the human cost of sanctions. And at some point, there's going to be so much collateral and so much human punishment of ordinary people. I think the international community will start taking steps back and saying, wait, I think this is too much. And I think it's our job. I'm so glad we're having this conversation because I feel very strongly about that.
Dr. Kibi Park, director of the North Korean program at the Korean American Medical Association. Dr. Park, thank you so much for being here.
My pleasure.
That familiar sound is Ladysmith Black Mambazo from South Africa. They've been around for generations. They first formed back in 1960, and as members have come and gone, the band has recorded more than 50 albums performed with artists ranging from Dolly Parton to Josh Groban and, of course, Paul Simon. The Grammy Awards are coming up later this month, and Ladysmith Black Mambazo is nominated for two albums, Shaka Zulu Revisited and a children's album, Songs of Peace and Love for Kids and Parents Around the World. That album brings a pretty simple message to a new generation of listeners.
We are Ladysmith Black Mambazo from South Africa. We sing songs about peace, about love, and about people helping each other.
The North American tour for Ladysmith Black Mambazo begins today in Washington State, and we talk with two longtime members, Talani Shabalala and Albert Mazabuco, stop by, along with their manager, Mitch Goldstein. We talked about their music, their U.S. tour, and what things like Grammy nominations mean when you've been doing your music for so, so long.
It feels great because I remember when we started the group, the founder of the group, Joseph Shabalala, used to say, if we can do it right and then do it constantly, good things will come for the group. So now I can see this. Wow, good things and the big things are happening for the group. So I'm very grateful and I'm humbled to say that, here I am again.
All over the world, all women are beautiful. The east, the north, the south, the west, all over the world.
Well, Albert, one of the albums that's nominated might have surprised some people. A children's album, a kids' album. Tell me why Ladysmith turned to the kids for this one.
Ladysmith Black Mambazo music is about peace. So we believe that peace, if it can plant it to the young people, to the children, bring them together with their parents, that's going to be a good thing.
Hello, Plazi, wine, da-da.
Dark.
With a quack, quack, yeah, and a quack, quack, there. Nai-quack,
jumping down, we quack, quack. Talani, you've got a second album nominated for a Grammy as well. The first is the kids' album, of course. Shaka Zulu Revisited is also nominated for a Grammy, so you've got two shots at it. Why did the band think it was a good time to do, a reprise of some of the older songs?
Shaka Zulu was recorded in 1986, and it is a very important album because it is the first album that was produced by Paul Simon.
His honor. nobushungu nobushupela akungene kona nokukhala.
The one who opens the way with for ladies with Black Mambazo to tour around the world. My father, he's just got retired or stepped back in the group like 2 years ago. So we honored them, especially them, and also the past members, the members who passed on, who were in Ladies with Black Mambazo. We felt it is a good time now to redo their songs, and here's the album. Izolo nobuhlungu nokuhlupheni akungeni khona obuzobuya uJesu emhlabeni obuzobuya uJesu emhlabeni wena uzoshona wongelayo uJesu.
Chime in, Mitch.
You know, Todd, a lot of people ask about the original group. It's how they say it. Oh, what about the original group? And they're referring to the Paul Simon era group. And those members have either retired or passed away, sadly. But people don't realize that the newer group, quote unquote, has been together since the early 90s. Tulani and his brothers, Joseph brought them into the group in 1993. So they, as well as others who've joined around that time, this Ladysmith Black Mambazo group has been together over 20 years, longer than any other span of Ladysmith Black Mambazo. So we just thought it was appropriate on the 30th anniversary of the release of this incredibly significant album, Shaka Zulu, which won their first Grammy Award, that this quote-unquote new group that's been around for 20 years... re-record these songs and say, hey, this is us now, and we're celebrating the past, but we're also saying, you know, we've got something to offer as well.
Rain, 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 beautiful rain, oh, come,
never come,
oh, come,
never come,
oh, come to me, beautiful rain,
beautiful rain,
oh, come,
never come,
oh, come,
beautiful rain,
oh, come to me.
Well, Albert, you're in a position to be going all across America now at a pretty important time, in some ways a troubling time in America. And you've been in the band since 1969, a long arc. And you also have experience living in South Africa through apartheid and what it means to live in a country under some of the most extreme forms of racial prejudice. I ask most of the artists and most of the musicians who come on this show how they're feeling about this moment in America now, because of all the people that you meet, all of the things that you see, and the fact that you have a platform and a microphone, and I think in your case, a long view maybe of history. How do you view what's going on in America right now?
I'll tell you the story. When I grew up, I grew up with my uncle. He was a very mean person. We never see him smiling, but I saw the power of music. There was a time that he came back from Johannesburg. He brought a gramophone, and then he brought some records. So he put those records because we were very excited to hear. That was my first time to see my uncle smiling when he's listened to that music, and then he dances. It was a music, just instrument. So in that experience, and then it tells me that wherever we go with our music, we will be a solution where there is a turmoil in this world.
Talani, I hear what Albert has to say, and I have a question I have to ask you that I wish I didn't have to ask you, frankly. What did you think when you heard about what the president had to say during that immigration meeting at the White House, what he had to say about countries in Africa?
For me, for Mambazo, what we do is to preach love, peace, and harmony around the world. I hope there would be peace here in America. I hope there would be peace everywhere in the world, including my country. We have problems of our own. Every country has its own problem or its own views. People view things in different ways. I didn't take it personally, but I feel, I pray that there will be peace in this world. People will treat one another with respect and also with love.
Gentlemen, thank you so much for being here.
Yes, thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Talani Shabalala, Albert Mazabuco, and Mitch Goldstein, all part of Ladysmith Black Mambazo, nominated for 2 Grammy Awards, and their U.S. tour starts today. Oh, that's a nice way to go out today. The sounds of Ladysmith Black Mambazo touring across America might be coming to your town for the old folks. And now for the kids, too. That's all for us today. Give us your take, as usual, at 8778MyTake. You can always tweet us at The Takeaway. Thanks so much for being with us this hour. I'm Todd Zwillick. This is The Takeaway.
PRI, Public Radio International.
On Notes from America, we have conversations with people across the country about how we can truly become the nation that we claim to be. Each week, we talk about race, our politics, education, relationships, usually all of them, because everything's connected. And you, our listeners, are at the center of those conversations. I'm Kai Wright. Join me on Notes from America, wherever you get your podcasts.